know, and leave immediately instead of maybe hanging out for 5 for 10 minutes or half an hour. But the fact that we'd bring in 60 people for these Noise Fest things that would hang out, buy food, because they're all traveling people, and you know, so
spending money on food.
Yeah, they were happy to have us there, and then we're not a crowd that tears up stuff either.
Yeah,
you know, you don't have people tearing out furniture or busting out lights or windows and being a general hassle.
Is everything going? Dr. Oblivious, straight from New York, here on Frank Moore Shaman's Den. D-A-R. Darn.
Darn.
Oh, that it's a crowd that doesn't tear things
up. Yeah, yeah. It can be a pleasant change.
We may...
Change that. Yeah, it may be. Well, Uber Kunst always tore things up, but that was them on stage.
Uh-huh. So who is that?
Uber Kunst.
Uber Kunst.
The guy that books the shows, the Jet Rock, is Uber Kunst. That's his project. So no one would play after Uber Kunst for years.
Is he playing this year, too?
I think they are. I haven't really paid that much attention.
That name rings a bell.
They probably are.
Yeah.
So he had talked about giving up his spot before, so I don't know if it ever... panned out that direction or not. We'll find out.
He wants he wants nudity.
Yeah. When I told him about you guys, he was like, great, wonderful, bring it on. And I wasn't sure how he was going to react to it, but I was doing it as a warning,
right.
And he was just absolutely ecstatic as far as, like, he was like, great, fine, I'm perfectly okay with it. So
good.
Yeah, Noise Fest will be fun this year. Should be, there's a lot of talent, so.
Yeah. And it's our 10th year. So you playing with us and Lob?
Haven't, like, officially heard from Lob as yes or no. Traditionally, I do play with Lob, and Instagon is... For the longest time, when Instagon would tour, which is, Instagon's never the same group of people twice, but Lob and I would leave Southern California together on a tour, and then, you know, rope people into performing with us, and the band, subsequently the band always changed and was different every time we played Sacramento, but I had been,
Like the Toronto All-Stars.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you have people who are there for long, they might do a long stretch and then might... not do. I mean, Instagon does tons of shows without me.
Right.
You know, there's big, giant spaces. I really wanted to go down and do the 400th show, but haven't been able to get it, but, like, the 420 show's coming up. And so I want to do that number. Like, that, I'm like, oh, 420, And then Keith, the saxophone player that's up here now, wants to go down, so I'll probably drive down with him to do the 420 show.
Yeah.
If he actually gets it. Keith can sometimes flake, or work gets in the way, too. So it's just,
yes, we have the experience of the flaking.
And then he showed up that one time, that last show, and that was a complete surprise to me. I didn't expect him to walk in and play, and it was great and wonderful that he did.
Yeah.
I was thrilled beyond belief, so.
Yeah. How did you, meet Lob?
I met Lob through a guy. I basically got in a car with some friends of mine one afternoon, and they said, hey, have you heard this band Hitler's Bikini? And I said no. And they go, you're going to crack you up. They played me this tape, and it was hysterical. About that time, I had moved to Costa Mesa and gotten a flyer for a local cafe, and Hitler's Bikini was going to play, so I figured I'd go get a copy of their demo tape. I totally had the flu that week. I was just barely able to get out of the house to go. I really just intended to basically go there, get this tape, and leave. And Andy didn't have any of the tapes. Andy was the singer. And a couple weeks later, I ran into him at another club. We were both there to see, and I don't even remember what band it was, but we were both there to see it. We were both just chit-chatting, and Andy's a really friendly guy. I told him, at that time I was working for this environmental consulting firm running the photocopy room. And I told him, it's like, oh, well, if you want me to make flyers for your band, I'm totally willing to subvert this company. You supply paper and I'll hide the numbers kind of thing. And they he was like, well, I don't think I need flyers, but I wanted to print up like a chapbook that he had written, a short story. And I was like, well, I'll do it. It's no big deal. You know, just get the master. So I go over to his house one day. And he lived in Costa Mesa, too. And he had this big, giant Bob Dobbs head on the wall. Mm. And I'm like, where did you get this head? Why do you have Earth, Wind, and Fire records out? And Andy and I just totally hit it off. And then he was like, I got to introduce you to my friend Lob. And Andy Warthog introduced me to Lob, took me to this poetry reading that Lob was hosting. So I started working with Instagon, essentially doing things like printing up. At that time, we were publishing a book called The Never Ending Page, which was an open submission journal. We didn't write reviews or edit anything, so long as it was, you know, wasn't obscene enough that we could just give it away for free on the streets, we didn't have a problem with it. And all I did really was print them, and then bring these finished copies over. And we did offset printing covers, so those were done by someone else. And then there was an assembly party that put these magazines together, and I just basically show up with this crate of paper and drop it off and go home. And then I started doing just volunteering to do like cover the door at shows or help move equipment. And one day, Lob's like, "Well, you want to play music?" And I was like, "I haven't played music in years."
Oh wow!
So I borrowed a bass from a friend of mine.
And why? Why not? Why hadn't you played music?
It had just stopped. It was. What I played in high school was percussion, was drums, and that's kind of difficult to lug around. Actually, I had the one drum I did have, I had a snare drum, actually got stolen from a storage unit in this apartment complex that I lived in. And it was, you know, I was just like, you know, not replacing it, I'm poor, I, you know, I make $6 an hour kind of thing, and I just had no other outlet. LA, I suppose, it's like I could have found a place if I really put my mind to it, but I... It just wasn't what I was. I was too busy trying to get food in my mouth at the time, you know, like to do anything else. And yeah, art was just never something that was done in school. Like once you got past second grade, you know, it just stopped.
Wow.
And then yeah, so Lob just basically suckered me back into doing creative stuff. And so it's his responsibility that I'm out doing what I do now. It's his fault. Blame him.
We were doing, TCR, right, that's how we met him. He sent us some Instagon literature when we were doing the zine, the Trotic Revolutionary, and
okay.
We really liked the whole rap about it, so didn't we publish a whole section on Instagon in one issue of our zine?
Excellent. Yeah, because, and I'm trying to think, I mean, I knew you guys lived up here when I moved up here, and I knew eventually I would work with you. It was just one of those things that was like...
Why? Why did you know that?
It's just one of those things you know. It was. I knew what you did, and like remember when we met, which was over that band walking out on you at the UC Berkeley shows.
Right.
The first thought that ran through my head was, how did they get involved with you and not know that you do nudity, and what your shows were about?
Right.
So that just boggled my mind. And then at that point, when like Nathan and I's project had kind of like had stagnated, we weren't working.
Us too. It boggled our mind, too. Yeah. Well, that was the thing where the drummer had played for us before in Wilmington, North Carolina. He had been our waiter at a restaurant. And Frank said, hey, do you play
an instrument?
I need a band. And so he and Frank said, get your musician friends. I need somebody for a performance. And so they did play it was a ritual performance, but they were like in the space where people came into, and then they went into this kind of cave thing. But, I mean, Mikey and I were nude. I mean, so he did know all about that. So we think what happens is that he didn't tell the people he was in the band with much about what we were about.
Right. He just said, let's go play or do this thing.
And I think they were impressed over UCB that we had this ongoing gig at UCB. Like
right.
The first words they said to me when they were loading their stuff in was, how did you get this gig? So I think they might have had some picture of
somebody
who performs at UC Berkeley.
Right.
And, yeah.
Like a Zellerbach Hall kind
of. Right, right, Right.
Yeah, they thought they were going to have a crowd of like 5,000 people or 2,000. You know,
yeah, I don't even know that.
Yeah, so who knows what they were thinking about. Yeah.
There was, well, there was a, that was like a big crowd. It was
that night?
The first night it was packed.
Oh, wow.
It was in a different room.
Yeah.
It was in the art building. It was a large space, and it was just packed with people. There were people that had come to our series in the 80s that were there that we hadn't seen since then.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, it was actually a pretty dynamic evening because the place was packed, and it was like everybody was, like, into it, you know. And so they really, they couldn't complain about that. It had, like, that kind of glamour to it,
right,
if that's what they were into. But I was giving. I was not there. P.I. picture of the artist. Frank wasn't their picture of
right.
the artist.
Right. Yeah, they couldn't. Yeah, I can see it. Where right. people be, oh, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. Don't know why.
Yeah. Yeah. S. So. You. Had heard of Frank's work
right.
before you knew us.
Right. Not that I'd ever seen a performance or even any videos or anything, but I knew of your existence and...
How? How did you...
How did I hear about you?
Yeah.
You're asking me to draw up details. let's see. How did I know? I mean, I knew... I definitely, the most recent prior to my coming up here was contact with through Lob. I mean, because Lob and I are very close and work, you know, Lob and I just, we're friends. We talk all the time. So I knew, like, when he got in contact with you. But before that, it was probably through Annie Sprinkle, perhaps, or something. So there's this weird, I have a weird circle of friends, and it's always funny to me when I find other people that work. Like, when I said asked Lena to play with us. Lena's like, oh, I did something with Frank before. Like, so it was just like, oh, I didn't think she'd have any contact because I knew she came out from the East Coast. But, so I can't remember exactly, but it was probably something through the Annie Sprinkle crowd, or I read your name on a list of something and found out about you and said, oh, this is something I got to get into, you know, hook up with eventually. And... Once I started doing creative stuff, it was just like, oh, eventually I'll probably, if nothing else, see a show, which essentially is being in a show.
Right.
So I just expected it to happen. I wasn't always, like, going, got to call Frank this week. Got to make sure that the next 2 months I'm doing something with him or find out what he's up to. But it's, you know, it's one of those, like, feelings you have.
Right.
And it was, I was right. It was right.
Oh, over over two years, what about, that we've known
but,
you over
yeah,
2 years?
Yeah, it's been about 2 years since that we've been working together, yeah. So
it was the beginning of the UC series,
right? That's when it was, and... you and I were communicating because I had no idea. I was all like trying to. What I had envisioned for what you wanted for a band was like a more traditional band that played like danceable music or something, and that's not what I do at all.
F-O-O-L, foolish. B, O, foolish boy.
Yeah, foolish. Totally. So I was trying to. We were emailing each other back and forth. I was trying to explain like I do this very. Off experimental weirdness, and I was going to get you a tape or something, and then you sent me an email saying that the shows got canceled.
H-E, right. Hey. If L O if Lob B A back me Why? How? T. R. A. Traditional. Can I be?
Yeah, so, well, it was more, I didn't know what you were doing. Like, I figured, well, maybe he does different shows all the time.
Right.
Like, so I didn't know what you had planned for doing at UC Berkeley for 4 hours, you know, kind of thing. I knew you wanted, you wanted dancers. So it was all like dancing, dance music. I need to think about that. I suppose I could find a drum machine. Is that
T A N Tango.
Tango, yeah. Let's hear it for Casio's and their pre-programmed beats, you know. But here I am now.
Yeah. Y R U H O O Hooked.
Hooked. I'm playing with you?
Yes.
Good question. Because I wouldn't think to describe it as hooked. I enjoy collaborative efforts. And what I'm trying to maybe develop with my own art is to get people to understand that they can entertain themselves. And they don't have to be the best musician, singer, whatever in the world to do that. That they just the act of creating this stuff on their own could fill that void, and they could stop buying corporate mass-produced culture.
Yes.
So that's why I use like cheesy equipment. You know, some of the equipment I have is relatively nice, but it's antique. That it was never. It's not like no one's ever out. You know, you don't see a bunch of people on stage with Roland SH5s like, oh, that guy's got one of those. You don't hear people talking about wanting to be a keyboard player really even too much. But, and then those Casios just were never meant to be used as on stage theatrical instruments. And I just want people to understand they can just wire all this stuff together and get, so long as they get a sound out of it that they like, it's folk art. That they can just sit at home and do this, and they don't have to watch MTV or whatever. But if they want to, they can. It's
I did a S. Oh, a soundtrack on. I'm using Casio and bunch of like little delay and stuff things. Mm-hmm. It was our musician at the UC Berkeley series in the 80s lent us his setup, and we extended this board on Frank's board, and
right.
we like kind of set taped everything
down
on
right.
it. And but it was a Casio and just delay stuff.
Right.
And Frank would just play on our TV, our living room TV. He'd play the movie through once, and we could record, I think, 3 tracks
uh-huh.
on it.
Right.
And so he'd play 1 track down, and then he'd play the movie a second time and lay a
second track down,
but he couldn't hear the first track.
Right. You couldn't hear playback. You
right.
Hear, yeah.
And that's how he did the soundtrack, but it was using, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and I did that as one of my other bands, like I was talking earlier about having other projects, like I named things later, decide where it fit into, where I took a 4-track recorder. And then I would create pieces on 1 track as an individual piece, like going, okay, like figure out how I wanted things to start and end, and then record myself getting between those 2 points. And then fill up that 1 entire track, and then switch to this to another track, and do the same thing without ever listening to any of the other previous tracks.
Right.
And then when I decided to record it to a finished product, I sat there and remixed all 4 tracks together. And so things faded in and out. Like, it was just to see how it randomly would sync up. And
right.
I had a good time with it. I was like,
it is amazing how good it... Yeah, when we listen to the soundtrack
mm-hmm.
of that, it's like, wow. You know, this is, like, really good. It's subtle. It's nice music. And
right.
just doing it that way.
Exactly. It's,
yeah.
it's amazing what you can do with a delay pedal. It really... That's one of my favorite... pieces of electronics.
Uh-huh.
It's, getting a mixing board, that was probably one of the best pieces of advice somebody had given me this, Dave Wright from Not Breathing,
mm-hmm.
said, get a mixing board.
Uh-huh.
Get a mixing board, and said, you're going to love it. You're going to love it. So, and he was right. So now I have 2.
People think they need to do things a certain way.
Right. Yeah, I really like that's like when you ask me what key you sang in, and I've explained to you it's it really doesn't matter. If it sounds good to you and you're happy with it.
Yeah, if you want me to tell them why that came up, a future guest on that will be a future guest on the Shaman's Den. Frank asked her if he and she could sing I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry together. And her response was, we could give it a try. And she asked Frank what key he sang in. And so, and so Frank asked Dr. O today, so what key do I sing in?
He said all of them.
All of them. At O, at once.
At once, yes. At once. Hey, Kate Bush sings in like four octaves, you know, it's just like she can jump, and that's an amazing thing from listening to her be able to do that. It's her talent. It's
like P, like when you play the piano, you don't play it in a traditional
sense.
Way.
No.
It sounds really good.
Yeah, it's... Again, it's always what it finally sounds like, and if you're happy with it or not, and you just keep playing until you get to the point where you can control it enough to where you're happy with it. I used to play a horribly detuned piano just to play it. Like, when I was a kid, my mom was like, you're going to take piano lessons, and I was like, Oh God, no!
Leave me alone.
I'm having fun. little did I know, I'm like recreating stuff John Zorn had done, or kind of, like off tune things. And I just had no sense of it. I just was like playing things. I was like, okay, that sounds good, and I'm gonna keep doing that, and just kept figuring out how to play keys. And but no plan. No, it was just making myself happy on this keyboard. But. Do we want to talk about the RNC now? Or move on? Or you have more questions?
I will get to that.
Okay.
He's got a plan.
He's got a plan. All
but right. It's not that you have a plan.
Yeah.
You just have an intention to get to that.
Okay.
But I M S E setting you.
Oh, setting me up. Okay. Yeah. I should have guessed that. Yeah. It's like, how long have I known you? I should have saw that come. It's like, wait a second. What are you dealing these cards out here?
Like you. Don't L O O. You don't look like A V I violent A N
Anarchist. Yeah, well, you know, I know a lot of anarchists, and I wouldn't say that violent is a word I would describe even most of them with. So,
yeah,
I think that's part of a myth.
That is how, that is why, what, that is what they are P.U. pushing that myth.
Yeah, and me. Oh, absolutely. And it's, yeah, it's, yeah, this past week that I've been home, like, watching just media coverage of other events. I've, like the hurricanes going through heading up into to Florida in general. It hit me one day that they always talk about every other island, like the Grenada being hit by it, or being in the Bahamas and whatnot, but they would always show on the map this big giant island and this hurricane wiping right over it, and never mentioning the name of that island was Cuba. And I'm like, why do they avoid saying Cuba's, you know, just as vulnerable to all of these acts of nature?
J. But H. E. Hey. They are not H. U. Human and Cuba.
And Cuba, yeah, it's a deliberate attempt, you know, to control. I've always said the media controls what you see and hear, and therefore what you think and talk about. But most people, I mean, it's hard getting other people to see it that way.
Yes. You and until they are, until they are E. A. Read about something they were a part of, and see the discrepancy between what their experience was and what is how it's written up.
Right. I've had friends tell me about. They've asked me like, "Oh, what was your experience in New York? What did you see, hear, do?" sort of thing, and then me describe. So I'll save the stories, but then they go, "Yeah, all we got here was if any coverage, it was simply the number of arrests," which puts nothing into perspective whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I've been participating in direct actions for about 2 years now, also maybe a little bit longer, maybe a little bit less. Like I was at the Oakland dock actions when they were shooting at people. And then going home and hearing the news media coverage of the event, going, wow, that's so not like what I experienced there, you know. It's like I was wondering if they were at the same dock I was at.
They N-E, never, S-A, said, S-H-O-O, shooting, P, people.
Yeah, they were definitely shooting people directly in the face with these wooden dowels, and the really famous picture of, I believe her name was Saoirse, like, she came walking up the street from that, where that initial dock was that she was at. I was in between the two picket lines, and I saw this swelling on her face, and my first thought was, oh my God, her jaw's broken. Like, you know, like, because I'm about like a quarter mile, half mile down the road from me, and so I'm seeing are like smoke grenades going off, and I'm hearing the shots and seeing people run around, and just, so I start moving up, and she comes out of this chaos, and my first words out of my mouth were, are you okay, or something, or can you speak? Mm-hmm. And when she did, it shocked me. I thought for sure her jaw was going to be broken. I was going to be, like, getting broken teeth out of her face, out of her mouth, and going from there, and not having, I didn't even have medical supplies. I wasn't doing medic work that day. I didn't expect the picket line to become violent in any way, form, or fashion, because picket lines are an established, you know, form of protest. It's perfectly legal. It shouldn't be an issue unless, you know, some sort of confrontation happens between individuals. So it was a shock.
It was a F L A flash back to the T U turn of the century the Emma Goldman period.
Yeah, back. Yeah, and it was also like the second direct action, you know, second major protest after the bombing had started. And I remember thinking, ooh, it's going to go downhill from here fast, isn't it? If they're already to the point where they're going to be shooting at us. So I, you know, we're talking
about Oakland. And
yeah, this is April 7th.
April 7th.
Of 2003, I guess it was. Yeah. So that was, I mean, it was, prior to that, I had only ever gone to, like, marches, like, rallies against whatever, and I like the direct actions better because it actually has an impact where I've always, like, these protest marches on weekends to empty federal buildings and government buildings just kind of seems like it's good exercise,
Define direct action.
Direct actions, not being any, I'm not going to say that this is like the official definition of direct actions, but a direct action is real involvement, generally through civil disobedience, that forces an issue to a head or to at least has some sort of disruptive goal, it seems. Everyone uses it. I mean, Operation Rescue, barricading of abortion clinics was a direct action. They were engaging in direct civil disobedience. It wasn't just lobbying the government to stop whatever it is you're against. When they, back in the 60s, when they tried to, I believe, stop troop transports, like stop men from being enlisted, people being drafted, going into the enlistment centers, those are direct actions. The mouse block.
S. So, I. T. Was it SIT? No, yes.
The sit-ins.
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 Would be direct action.
Right, like the civil rights movement when they had the sit-ins in the cafes, you know, and sit in the whites-only section and shut that restaurant down, essentially. Those are direct actions. It has an impact on those businesses. It forces the media comes out for it. You know, it brings attention to things. The tree sits that happen up in Oregon and Washington and Northern California. So those are direct actions to stop them from doing something. And it's, to me, I like those better than just writing letters.
S. I. Sit-ins. Sit-in. S-I-T. T. Sitting. On. The. T. R.
Train tracks.
Train tracks.
To stop trains from moving. No, what about them?
Giving them as an example of
right,
direct
actions. Yeah, I heard I think it was in Scotland, the conductors, essentially, or the train operators, refused to move weapons that were being shipped to Iraq. Like, they took it upon themselves to not transport those things and stop those trains from moving, simply because they had the power to do it. And people feel powerless, and not just in their government, but in their lives in general. And I think direct actions help show them that they don't, that really, you're the guy that controls this.
W. H. I. While. H. E. R. E. While here. They. R. A. N. Ran. O. Over. B. R.
Brian Wilson.
He was the guy that laid himself across the track. It was
Livermore,
the nuclear.
Oh, at Livermore weapons.
And they actually
lab.
Rode over him and cut his legs off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this was a number of years ago.
Corey Rachel, that you have the poster for, she was essentially engaging in a direct action and got bulldozed. The guy in Tiananmen Square that got run over by a tank was same thing.
I. and I was in the L-O-N longest sit-in of a federal building.
Oh, really?
That was when they were about the disabled laws, the federal laws.
When they were
in San Francisco, they there's a whole bunch of people trying among them that pretty much camped out in the federal building there.
Wow, excellent.
And eventually got the law passed.
Okay. Yeah. The was it the disabilities American with Disabilities Act? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, and it seems like a shame that we have to go to these measures. But
it isn't historically that's the way things have changed.
Right. It's you know, the saying that all evil needs to triumph is for good men to do nothing.
Right.
And that's really, really what it is. And direct action is when good men actually finally start doing something. Mm-hmm. And you can always argue, well, how big of an impact are you having, sort of thing. And it's like, wait till it's all over before you tell me that I'm a failure, you know. Or
right. Historically, that is how change happens.
Right. I mean, we have the word boycott because of essentially direct actions that were taken against. I think his name was Charles C. Boycott, who was like a landlord in Ireland. And people stole his mail, destroyed his crops. Ultimately, he like fled with his life. That was like, you know, he left under like total fear. Because of these people going, oh, he's just out of control. And he was a landlord at the time. I don't remember all the details. I wish I had every book I ever had. At my hand, I pull that off my shelf, and we're at my house. I go, wait a minute, I got this information. But that's where we get the word boycott from, is because of what happened to this guy, and that was direct actions. It used to be like, rich and poor lived much closer together, as opposed to how we're very segregated now. And I know that there were instances, like if you were in like Parliament or did whatever, and you did a vote that people were upset with, you came home, you could literally have found garbage dumped on you as you walked in your building because neighbors that were affected by you that were lower social class saw you coming home. And
Frank is going,
yeah, good idea. It's like those, like the guys that pied Brown several years ago and got ridiculous sentences.
Right.
You know, somebody who beat their wife would have gotten less time than, so people, you know, it's definitely, there's been a change in strategies
from the power structure.
Yeah. They see how things happen and take measures to protect themselves.
They have tried to make people protest they've tried to make protest into a P-O-L political, P-O-L-I-T-E, polite, R-I, ritual.
Right. It's there. And when I went to New York, I went to, first thing I did was go to an ACLU meeting. And unbeknownst to me at the time, just going into this meeting, I just expected this to be an ACLU meeting about what to expect. And they had invited the media. CNN was there. I talked to, I think he was a reporter for the Times. And this one girl came up to me and said, introduced herself as a student from Columbia University's journalism department and wanted to follow me around, or wanted to know if it'd be okay if she could follow me around with the during the protest for the coming week. Mm. And I told her, okay, but there might be restrictions. We'll talk about it. We'll get in touch after this meeting. And she wanted to compare essentially how marches are. Like, what the first thing was on Sunday, which was the day before the convention opened, this United for Peace and Justice march. Mm. And the big controversy there was that they wanted to march through town and then go to Central Park and have a rally, and then the city wasn't going to give them permission to be in Central Park, and they wanted them to go to some highway or some other roadway. Mm. And then that was an issue, and then there was all this back and forth legal wrangling, and ultimately it ended with them being allowed to have the march, but then it just sort of had to, like, magically disappear when the permit for them to be on the streets expired.
Since when is, since when do you have to get
permission to
protest? Permission to
protest your government? Yeah, that's, no?
Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, that's it.
To get
a permit to protest. Did L.A. labor, when the labor, all the labor protests?
Back in the 1800s, it got us the 8-hour.
Did they all have permits?
Yeah, no. I'm going to say those guys were definitely not having permission.
So at what point did it start that people were getting permits for protests,
it's people only pay attention to, like, sort of like hot issues of the day at the time, and then things get passed when people aren't looking, really. And I'm not sure when the historic moment when someone who first said, oh, you, if you're going to march down a street, you have to have permission to block traffic.
And they
fly it as a safety issue, is what it is.
And when did we start accepting that?
You know, people, nobody wants to be arrested. Nobody wants to go to jail. It's not a pleasant experience. Nobody wants to have their head busted open. That's not a pleasant experience. You know, it'd be interesting to find out, like, someone to map all this out, going, okay, well, whose idea was this originally? But
because it's funny, because you're saying that that implies that the reason they're accepting the permit idea is so they won't have to go to jail, get their head busted. But they get the permit, and more people are going to jail, and more people are getting their head busted.
Right.
So it didn't even accomplish that.
It's, yeah, a lot of it's fear. I mean, people are manipulated through fear, and our government is just as guilty of it as anybody else in the world. The fear of being caught, the fear of punishment, I'm not sure where I'm going to go with this, but it's...
But the TRU, the truth is, if we are going to see H change things, we will get our heads banged in. We will go to jail. We will get K.I. killed.
Yeah, it's going to happen. It's happened in the past. It's a shame. I think the forefathers kind of had, like, a good ideas with, like, having the government change every 4 years sort of thing as a way to sort of, like, nip in the bud the need for violent revolutions. But I don't think they ever wanted the revolutionary spirit to go away. That they always wanted people out there wanting to change things and to be and to participate, wanting to participate. And I think we've just, society overall has become very complacent. And but these things are, like you said, are going to happen. I've already been to jail twice in the last 2 years. And, you know, up until until the beginning of this whole incident, I wasn't. I had a perfectly clean record, you know. I was a good little upstanding citizen. So, as much as I did my own little things in my own little world and didn't bother anyone, but.
What? How? Why? Did you see change?
Well, I don't think it was that I ever changed. I've probably walked off more jobs for moral reasons than jobs people have ever had. But it
like
was
that. That is a direct action.
Yeah, it's like even if it wasn't something that the employer did to me, if it was something that was I just found objectionable if they did to someone else, I'd be like, you know, I don't want to work for you. You know, I don't want to associate with you at all, and I'm leaving now, today. I'm not giving you 2 weeks' notice or anything else. I'm just simply cutting our relationship to a short right here.
That is the K-E. That's the key to how to change things.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that my quitting a job ever changed them, but it definitely raised their consciousness about, oh, maybe people won't take everything lying down, that there are people out there that will stand up for themselves and each other. And I've always said, like, if we wanted Bush to leave from the moment that he was elected, a general strike would have done it.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know what, everybody, don't go to work. Just 2 weeks, this starts dragging into 2-3 weeks.
J-H-E, hey. 4-C-A-C-A-R, cars, D-R-I, driving, S, driving at 1-0. 10 miles an hour on the
freeways.
Freeway.
Yeah, there's
would
shut thing. Yeah, it starts slowing down, and it's
doesn't take much.
Yeah, it's like I said, people don't realize how much power is at their disposal in their daily lives. Just. I mean, you're not a unionized employee as an office worker. That doesn't mean you guys can't work together to protect each other. And go, look, you know what? We're going to start shutting our office down every Friday. We're all going to, like, not come into work, or half of us are not going to come into work every day. And if any action gets taken against any one of us, then we'll have a plan in place that says they go where the rest of them who didn't have, you know, whatever punishment take them against them, go up to the boss and go, look, we'll all walk out of here now if you don't reverse this decision.
But that don't, but that R-E requires willingness to R-I risk.
Right, it's, you know what, there's, I guess, you have to ask yourself, what's more important to you? That this piece, I mean, most people don't, I always tell people there's only two kinds of work in the world. There's life-sustaining work, and then there's paper shuffling. And the fact is, most of the people in our society engage in paper shuffling. If you're not a farmer or a doctor, I mean, you're really not engaging it too much life-sustaining activity. That's, you don't, I work in offices. I shuffle paper, I analyze information. no one's going to die if I don't do that for 3 months. You know, it's just, but it's going to make the guy who's collecting all the money at the end of the line be unhappy. And if he's the one who's causing my problem, now I've got his attention. And he's going to listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there's going to be risk and there's going to be loss, but we've got to, it's like the, what do they say during the revolution? We're either all going to hang together or we're going to all hang separately. You know, it's, so.
N-O, non-violence, don't mean there will not be the violence. No, is that it? Doesn't mean there will not be violence.
Right. It's that I, you know, when I look back through history, I don't think I've ever seen a social movement that was successful that didn't have some wing that was violent. You know, they had the IRA in Ireland. Would they have gotten the political change they wanted had the IRA not been out there setting off bombs and shooting people? Would the I'm hard-pressed to actually come up with a violent abolitionist outside of probably, you know, engaging in stealing slaves or helping slaves escape.
I mean... Even when the REV revolution is 100 people, 100% nonviolent. Even when the revolution is 100% nonviolent on the part of the revolters,
right.
that doesn't mean that the actual thing will have no violence in it.
Right. I mean, most people think violence just has to be physical. I mean, if someone's interfering with food supply, you know, deliveries.
He's also saying, like, if you that you have to take into account the reaction of those you're revolting.
Yeah.
Against.
Oh, it's and ultimately,
so
you know,
violence
what?
Might
the,
come
the,
from that direction,
yeah,
and you'll
I
be
mean,
involved
was,
in the violence.
The police were shooting at us in Oakland. Okay, it was not. We weren't being violent. We were.
So you were involved in the nonviolent protest, but it was you experienced violence, and it wasn't
because
the protest was violent.
Right. It wasn't a reaction to us.
H. A. N. D. Handing, H. A. N. D. No, Gandhi and King used violence.
Used nonviolence.
He said they used violence.
They used violence.
But. They used the violence from the other side to work for them.
Them, right.
So they're using violence, but it's from the other side. They, P, R, O, provoked. Violence
on behalf of from the law enforcement of the government.
Yeah. So you're saying they went in, they were being nonviolent, but they were provoking violence, and they kind of knew what they were doing, and they were using that because they knew the way the other people were going to react.
How wrong it was.
And it magnified how wrong it was, what was going on.
Right. Violence is always like the first refugee, first refuge of people with no ideas.
But that R.E. requires the willingness to get your head bashed in.
Yeah, it's when I went to New York, I basically left instructions with friends of mine here about what to do in the event that I wasn't coming back. Who got what, you know, essentially, like, not so much a will, but, like, every time I engage in a direct action, it's a battlefield, and I don't go onto it expecting to come back. I hope to come back, but you just don't know what's going to happen on the streets. Anything can happen. I might be the one guy out of 500,000 people that got turned into a vegetable because some cop clubbed him in the head too hard or whatever.
Right.
But I can't let that fear that might happen prevent me from doing what I think is right. So out I go. So.
S. So. What happened in New York?
So what? As far as my experience, what happened was not what I had planned to happen. Sunday was the first.
What did you plan to happen?
I planned on engaging in direct actions on the coordinated day of actions, which was Tuesday. Going to New York, I had essentially had two different groups of people that we were all leaving from here, and I had planned to work with. We were going to be in our little small group and do what we wanted. And those both fell apart for a variety of reasons. So I found myself in New York by myself, essentially. Mm-hmm. But I had contacts there. I needed to find out what they were going to do. Like, we hadn't discussed, like, via telephone plans or anything, and I didn't want that to happen. I said, just wait till I get there. We'll talk about it then. I'll decide if I want to do what you're doing and be on just sort of an extra hand. Friday was there was a group that had protested at the DNC convention, at the Democrats National Convention, and then marched to Washington or to New York to protest at the RNC convention. So that was the first thing I had done, was like go on their march, and that was a permitted march. We had a police escort, kept us in one lane of traffic open from Central Park where they had gathered to I think it was Union Square. A friend of mine who was hosting me there, she's not a political person. She doesn't engage even in these permitted marches. Like, she had never done any of this, but she came with me. And she was really freaked out by the police presence there. Like, when she saw them all lining up, she's like, oh, my God, they're lining up. They're gonna attack her. And I'm like, no, they're not. trust me, this is not a defensive police line. This is just them straightening up for some reason, whatever that was. While we were there, for some reason we needed to make a phone call or something, so we'd separated from the main group and had gone off to find a payphone. I ran into three older women who were on a corner, and they were like, well, what is this? What's going on? And it turned out that two of them were from Austria and one was from France. And I explained to them what was going on, and they were like, oh my God, we're so glad you're doing this. Everyone in Europe's like totally afraid of like Bush becoming elected again. And so I had this wonderful conversation with them, and the march actually had left and gone blocks away from us before I was able to, after a while I was like, okay, I have to go catch up with these guys. Because I was making contact with the people that I wanted to work with there at that march. And that must have been why I was looking for a phone, because I was looking to call his cell phone and find out where he was in this crowd of people and what to look for. And eventually did catch up with him at the end of the march. Now, my friend got a little freaked out by the police presence there. And after a while, she decided she didn't want to be in the streets with us. So she went out and got onto the sidewalk. And then she had an interesting experience.
Bad move
for her?
Yeah.
No, actually it was a good move for her. It was an experience. How one interprets as good or bad is utterly subjective. at the end of the march, when she and I caught up again, she told me what she encountered were people in the street who were, again, like those three women were like, well, what is this? What's going on? What are these people doing? And so she would talk to them and explain to them, oh, this group did this, and this is why they're here. And she found a lot of people, oh, good. It's fine that they're blocking me from crossing the street for 15 minutes or whatever long it took us to march through two or three intersections that they were at. And I was like, oh, well, that's interesting, because I never have that encounter, because I'm always in these marches. Mm. You know, I'm surrounded by like-minded individuals. So I don't have these kind of conversations. It wasn't until she and I were off to the side, and then I started having encounters with people who were like, oh, I hate this, they're here, and they're just wasting taxpayer money. And I'm like, well, we didn't ask the police to be here. You know, these are our streets. Where you would think if you were driving along and you saw a crowd of people in the streets, you would avoid them, hitting them, whether you had to stop or whatever. You'd figure it out.
Without the police being
presence.
There to tell
right.
you there.
Right. So is it really us that's wasting the money, or is it your government? Because ultimately the government wastes a lot of money on things that are questionable.
Right.
And from there, we got into conversations about what we wanted to see money spent on. He was like, because I asked him, I'm like, well, what would you rather see money spent on besides this? And he's like, well, education. And I'm like, well, that's interesting, because I got laid off from the education industry because business has been down. For the business I was at, we should have done, like, the day that I got laid off, $15,000 a day on average, and we did $4,000 that day that I got laid off. And I go, you know, that's a direct correlation to these actions, to these wars that we're engaging in. Education's one of the first things that'll get whacked. So we're having a very superficial conversation about it. But he didn't want to necessarily see money taken away from the military, and I'd asked him, well, what about taking money away from Israel? And that flipped him out. Oh, God, was he angry. How dare I not want to give our taxpayer money to Israel. I don't want to give my taxpayer money to any government that's engaged in a war. I don't want Colombia to have it. They've got a civil war going on. It's their problem. So long as we're propping up one side, it's not where I want to see how my money's spent. We have schools that are closing here. I have lots of friends that are teachers. I know what kind of facilities they work in. So it's, you know, I'd rather see taxpayers get more direct control over how their taxpayers' money is spent.
S-C-H school. T-A take M I L L million. W A R war T A take B oh schools take
millions
war takes billions.
Yes, and that's
you do the math. You do the math. Time before you can not do math. You do the math before you can't
do
the math.
Right, that's right. Yeah, it's yeah, I remember one teacher calling me up one day asking me if, you know, she's like, she was a history teacher, and she had gotten her high school class up to Vietnam. She was like, what do I teach my kids about Vietnam? She calls me up for my opinion, and I'm all like, well, what do you want them to know about Vietnam? And she's like, you sound like my professors, was her answer. Like, well, yeah, but you're in charge of teaching people. What do you think? What was a lesson you think should be drawn from this experience? And then I pointed out to her that one of her classmates was a Vietnam vet that was gone back to school with her. You know, here he is in his 40s and 50s getting his teaching credentials. I go, why don't you call him up and have him come talk to your class about what he experienced in Vietnam? and that worked out really well for her.
Mm.
So, but yeah, the because I worked in the education industry, we were very aware of Bush's educational policies, and where I'm opposed to those too, you don't see direct actions really being formulated around them. But I'm trying to think, how can I put this? Our education system is becoming more about teaching to the test, because we have all this standardized testing that everyone wants to get on board with, and it's really, you know, stagnating the educational development. It's like schools are like robbing kids of the desire to think, and wants to break them of that, to ask questions and. But yeah, it's not you can't just spend money on education. It's like, how is this money spent? You have to ask these questions, these more, look at these details. You can't just throw money at problems and hope they'll go away. Just spending more on education won't do it, because you got to think about who's making the decisions about what these kids learn.
Back to New York?
Oh, back to New York. Okay. Where were we?
I think you were telling that Frank had asked you, what did you plan on having?
I went to New York without a plan. I didn't specifically, I know I have guidelines that I will work in. Things that I'll do and things that I don't want to do. I have to take into account, you know, I'm deep inside enemy territory here. I'm not at home. You know, my support groups are limited, and resources are limited at my particularly when I'm 3,000 miles away from home. So I wasn't really sure yet. I hadn't made contact. I was at this march. It was great that I could be at this march to help this group do their thing, and then to make contact with this other group. So even at that night, I didn't know what their plans were. And basically, when I made contact with my friend, he gave me basically the legal hotline number. He gave me this book that contained lots of information about New York, just general information that you would, an out-of-towner would want to know. And I was like, oh, this is great that his group put together this book, or groups that he worked with put together this book.
Yes.
To help people. Then I learned the date of a meeting that I needed to attend about what they were going to do. And I was like, okay, great. Now I've got, like, in 3 days, I got to be at this meeting, meeting was going to be on Monday. The direct action, the coordinated day of direct actions was on Tuesday. I knew that going into the game. And then Sunday was the permitted United for Peace and Justice March. That was I can't remember if we covered this or not, but they were the ones that wanted to have the rally at Central Park, and were ultimately denied a rallying point altogether.
Right.
Because of the way they played their cards, you know, they ended up with this kind of, like, really giant march that suddenly had to disappear. I wasn't exactly sure how that was supposed to happen, because it was huge. It was monstrously big. It took, like, well over an hour to go a block, it seemed. So, now, I had hooked up with this reporter. Did you have
half a million is the number we got.
Half a million, 500,000?
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to say, because the government, in addition to, like, you having to get permits to protest, which is, you know, always funny, but generally they ban flyovers. Like, news media are not allowed to have copters over these sort of rallies, which prevent them from getting these shots, because it's like, I didn't complete the entire march, and I was there from like 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and marched until like 3 or 4 o'clock, and then decided that I needed to go off to this direct action that was happening on Broadway, in the Broadway area. The delegates were all being treated to shows, essentially Disney shows. And there has been this call for people to come essentially harass these delegates. It should be a show of force. And I told my reporter that I had in tow with me, I go, I don't know what's actually going to happen at this. It could be the police may have the entire area blocked off and won't let anyone who doesn't have a ticket for a theater into this area. Nothing could happen. This could be a big flop. Mm-hmm. But let's go check it out. So we did, and we encountered various little groups. What the police had done was that whatever theater the delegates were coming to, they had a crowd of cops. And the cops were just pretty much mellow, so long as you weren't blocking the street, and the groups that would like sit and chant on, like, they'd be across the street from the theater, and then they would be there for 5 or 10 minutes, and then they'd move on and go to like another theater. And so you had all these groups wandering around to all these different theaters, moving all over the place. And probably about 5 o'clock, my reporter decided to call it a day. She felt she had enough information to do a report. Then I followed this group, Billionaires for Bush, around. You know, they're a big theatrical, sarcastic group. They have these funny signs like a free...
Yes,
free,
we saw them on television.
Yeah, very high profile. Yeah. Watch them do some photo op stuff, and then it's getting to be, 5:15-ish. All the delegates are in the theaters. Billionaires for Bush decide they're going to go drinking. I'm now alone at this point. I'm not hooked up with any groups of people. I don't have my reporter with her recorders in tow, and decide, you know what, I've been out all day around marching in the hot sun, and I last time I ate food was like at 8 o'clock this morning. So I'm going to call it a day. Looked at my map, like, okay, the subway's that way. Started heading to the subway. At this intersection, the light's red. I stop. And then a group of kids, I don't know how many, 10, 20, not a massive group of people, are coming up the street. There's a couple cops following them on motorcycles. They come up to the light, and they stop. And it's like this queer punk group, youth group. And they had apparently, what I found out later was that they held a kiss in. They're all wearing these stickers that say, "Kiss me, but ask me first." And so I'm laughing and joking with them. The light changes, and we cross the street, and I'm listening to them talk, and like some people, "Where are we going? What are we doing next? What's our, blah, 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 blah." And then suddenly it's like, I hear a rush of motorcycles. And I turn and I see all these cops on these little moped scooters. They have these little scooters. Apparently, I think these might have been something they got recently. Everyone seemed to be always talking about these cops on scooters.
New toys.
Yeah, new toys. Right. So I hear all this roar of motorcycles, or, mopeds, essentially. It's a bunch of cops. And they form this little line around us. And then suddenly I hear this big clanking noise off to my left. So I turn back around, and this cop has thrown one of those metal barricades that they use, like, for when they have parades and stuff. They block off sections of the street and keep you off out of the parade route or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, they interlock. And so they blocked us off in the front. They've got us pinned in on the side. There's however many kids, 10 to 20 behind me. I'm on the outside of this group, essentially, because I was already at the intersection when they wandered on up. And the police announced that to get down on our knees, we're all under arrest. And so, as a group, we all kind of go down on our knees, and...
You may, you were, O-F-F off. For D dinner. You're on your way off to dinner.
To dinner, right. I'm on my way home. I've called it a day. Now, keep in mind, we're on the sidewalk. We're crossing with traffic signal lights, even.
That was what I... T-O-T-O-U. No, that is what I... T-H... thought. Your F R, your friend, was G O going to R U N run in to? Oh, when he said bad idea, when you said that your friend that you were, that was hosting you got onto the sidewalk,
right,
that's what he thought was going to happen to her.
She
what
would
happened
get
to you?
Right. Man. No. Yeah. It was. Yeah. The, I think the police had a different plan. You know, on these given days. So keep at the time. I don't know what's happening. It's like, okay, I'm under arrest, and I know better than to, I thought about bolting. I really did. The only thing that's standing between me and, you know, the subway two blocks away is this little metal barricade, which I can easily hop over or just simply throw out of my way. Whether I was going to outrun cops on motorcycles was another question. Whether they would bother to pursue me or whether this, like, I don't know these people. I don't know what they're going to do. So for a second there was a pause in my mind. What's my actions?
Would be R, E, S.
Resisting arrest. Yeah, and that's a completely different charge than.
Yeah.
So, like with the rest of this group, we've gone down our knees. Now, it's one of the kids, and I mean, it's relatively quiet. You know, there isn't too much noise. There isn't a lot of chaos going. And one person asked, "Why are we being arrested?" And then he asked the question, why are we being arrested? We have the right to know. Why don't you tell us why we're being arrested? We're on the sidewalk. We're not even chanting. And I wish I had a video phone. I wish I could have gotten this next few minutes on film. There was dead silence. We're surrounded by 60-some-odd cops, including at least 10 guys who are in these white shirts, and these are the commanding officers. These are the guys that call the shots. Not one of these cops had anything to say. They couldn't even make up a reason to why they were arresting this group. Then someone shouts, let's call the lawyers. So people start whipping out cell phones and start dialing the National Lawyers Guild. My contact had given me this rub-on tattoo, which I thought was this great idea. It was this rub-on tattoo of the legal number, and I'm like, if anyone needs it, it's this. And then somebody shouted, I need it. I read it to them. You know, somebody else said, let's write down badge numbers and names, and this girl that's next to me has a pen and paper, and I tell her, you write, I'll read. And I just start reading left to right officers' names and badge numbers. Then they start taking people away. They take two people away. I'm the third person they cuff. I'll engage in civil disobedience when I plan to, and now that I feel utterly justified in not cooperating whatsoever with these guys, being that I see my arrest as totally unlawful, I go limp, which is just a perfectly legal tactic. It is not resisting arrest. So I look at my watch. Now, I knew in New York that the clock starts running from the time they cuff you on the time they have to charge you. So it's 24 hours in New York. So I just lay down, and one of the white shirts guy goes, he gets extra charges. I don't know what those will be, but I'm being told I'm going to be charged with extra charges. Keeping in mind, I still don't know what my first charge is. I have no idea why I'm being stopped. Because there was no order to disperse. There wasn't even that. You guys need to break it up or something.
You were not E-W-I with anyone.
No. I don't know a single person in this group. My two friends didn't want to. I had gone to the march with my host, a mutual friend that lived in New York, and then the three of us met the reporter. The reporter and I went to the direct actions at what's called Mouse Block. They went home. from the march. So nobody knows anything about where I am or what I'm doing at this point. I'm completely alone in a strange city. Outside of that, I'm surrounded by other people. So I go limp. They cuff me. They put the wrist on so tight that my wrist would remain swollen for about 3 days after I got out of jail, and I got out of jail on Tuesday. So I'm arrested on Sunday. I got out of jail on Tuesday. Like Friday, my swellings go down. Up until, I mean, even when I got back to New York, you could see from New York, you could see ridge lines on my wrist from how tight these cuffs were on. And I'm still having, I get these residual, like if I make a fist and then bend my hand down, I'll get a numbness that'll shoot up. So some damage is done, whether it's permanent or of any significance, I don't know yet. So I'm segregated into a different van than other people. There's a guy guarding me in the van. I ask him, what am I being charged with? And he goes, I don't know. I just drive the van. I'll go ask. And I was totally surprised. It totally took me back. And he walks away from the van. And again, I think about bolting, but I am cuffed behind
and
my...
And? Get?
Get a burger while you're at it.
Get a burger. Yeah. Get me some food while you're at it. I haven't eaten all day. Yeah. So I was all, like, kind of dazed by that. And he comes back with one of the white shirt guys. And he goes, he wants to know what he's being charged with. And the guy in the shirt looks at me and goes, you're being charged with resisting arrest. Now you know. And walks out. And I'm like, okay, well, now I have something to tell my lawyer. I'm being charged with resisting arrest. Because I've now, at this point, made my decision. I'm completely going John Doe. I'm not just going to go limp. I'm going John Doe. I'm not going to give them any information. I'm not carrying ID. I never do to these sort of things. The only thing I've got on me is some cash and my bus pass. Or the subway pass. They bring in another John Doe. Ultimately, there were three John Does arrested, at least that day. One was in my van. There's a third John Doe I'd find out about later that I wouldn't meet until much later. And there's some Jane Does, and the Jane Does and the John Does are put into this one van, and then some other people, they fill it up.
At a family... A Doe family.
A John Doe family, yeah. We're all cousins now. From there, we're taken to Pier 57, which was set up as sort of a processing center. And it got the nickname of like the Guantanamo on the Hudson. And it really was like that. It was not as bad, which, keep in mind the hurricanes that went through Cuba, those guys are, I want to know what happened to those guys. Were they left in those cages that are outdoors, exposed to the hurricane forces that went through? They have like 30-foot high or so cyclone fencing with razor wire over it. The cages, I can't guess how many people they're designed to hold, but there's definitely not enough. I mean, the police said they only arrested like 250 people on Sunday, and we were pretty much all at the center at the same time, and there wasn't enough places for us to sit down. There were benches in these cages, but not enough room for all of us to sit down. The floor there is just caked in oil. It was some sort of bus washing facility. They had like this, this big giant, bristle things that spin that wash these buses. So the floor is covered in, essentially like street goo, oil, rubber, exhaust fume, caked on exhaust fumes. I've learned that was an asbestos site.
Yes.
So there's probably asbestos in that stuff.
Yes. W-H-I, which was why they moved the T-R-A-N Transportation Department out of there.
Out of that building? Okay.
Yes.
So while I'm, so there I'm in processing. The way they had done it is that they had kind of like a one pins with those low metal, little police barricades. And they were trying to keep all the arrestees with the same arresting officer. John Doe number two would, in addition to having to be brought onto the van, would not leave the van. Now, because you can be charged with disruption of administration, and I'm not really sure when, like I said, I didn't have a really good strategy going into this, and I was sort of prematurely taken. So I'm thinking, oh, we got a small group, there's only a few Jane John Does. You know, I'm constantly having to think about what I'm doing and what those repercussions that I'm going to face are going to be. So I've decided to walk off the van. We're waiting, and I'm with my arresting officer. Had four callers. Unfortunately for him, two of us were John Does. The John Doe number two refuses to get off the van, so he's brought out and he's laid down on the ground, and he refuses to get up and move down the line with everyone. Me and the three other guys have moved down the line, and then suddenly we were told to come back. So we're escorted back to where John Doe number two is still sitting on the ground. And this white shirt officer goes, I want you guys to sit here. No, stand here, because you're being punished because he won't move.
That is a C-O-M-M.
Yeah, a common tactic. It's a collective punishment to turn like the group against that kind of that person. And immediately... Well, I go, oh, well, since we're being punished, we might as well sit down.
Right. Why? No. Nothing to lose.
Right. Because what the white shirt guy wants us to, is we're now going to have to wait until be the last people processed. Well, we're all going to sit here. Well, whether it's here or over there in that cage, it doesn't really make any difference to me. So we tell John Doe, too, we go, there's nothing they're going to do to us that should have any effect on you. We completely support you and your utter noncompliance with them. And a guy hasn't said a word. Now, I've already been on the van with him for like an hour. And now we sit for another like hour or so, however long it takes them to process all these other people. And the white shirt guy, when we just said, oh, we'll just sit down, and we all just sat down together, he just like shook his head and walked out. Like he wasn't even going to deal with the situation anymore. So we wait there, and eventually we're processed through. What they had to do is bring in a busload of cops who were in like football helmets with these big, giant, plastic, white, clear shields. And essentially, it's a security thing. If in the event that he decides at that point to become violent, these guys are there to deal with that.
One guy. And this is all for one guy.
This is all for one guy.
There's one guy.
It's like one of those small school bus loads of police in total riot gear to deal with this guy. Now, what they're going to move him
with... Was he a big guy?
No. Not at all. Typical, you know, guy.
N-H, hard hats. H-A-N-D, handcuffs.
Yeah, he's in handcuffs.
Oh, he's a guy in handcuffs, and they need all these cops and riot gear to deal with this one guy.
Exactly. Which are a special force. They had to be driven in. They weren't there at the facility. These guys were brought from somewhere else. Get off the van. They all have to line up and be
he was
like
wasting insane. Money.
Yeah. So this is. Then they've got a cop filming them.
They have a cop filming them.
Filming this. The white shirt guy tells three other police officers who aren't in gear, "I want you to like pick him up by here, and you get him from under here, and this guy gets him from up here, and you're going to have to carry him." To the thing, but they're very, you can injure people by when you, that are limp by like folding them wrong or bending their backs or doing whatever, and in which case the police get a lawsuit against them for you know, excessive force or injury or whatever. So they remove him and take him off somewhere. This is a monstrous facility. It's a giant warehouse. Like, I couldn't even see to the back of it. Like, I've had to give up my glasses at this point. I'm sweating so much they keep falling off my face, so I have the cops just take them and put them with my bags and other stuff. Where then we're processed through, the three of us. And now while we're waiting on all this to happen, the arresting officer, like, I'm looking around just to trying to observe what's going on, figuring things out and making little notes in my head. And I'm wearing this T-shirt that says "The Working Poor." And I hear this guy off to the side of me go, "The working poor." And I turn to him because really he's reading my shirt. And he looks at me and he goes, "I work 4 fucking jobs." And I go, and I'm dead serious. I'm like, "You work 4 jobs and one of them is being a police officer. That's a hard enough job as it is." It's essentially, people don't realize it's a lot about police work, is a lot of it's social work. You're not catching criminals like so much. You're dealing with domestic violence. You're dealing with problems. Now, the New York Police Department, my information's right, have been working without a contract for 3 years.
Yes, that's right.
They've been working mandatory overtime, and when all this finally does get settled, they'll probably only get about 60% of that pay. So I'm talking to this guy about, like, I can see gears turning in his head, you know, like he's like, "Look, we're not against you guys, but what you're doing is wrong, and you know it."
Who's thinking that? The cop?
Oh, no, this is what I'm telling the cop.
That's what you're saying to the cop, "We're not against you guys."
Yeah, we're not, it's not, we're not just anti-police to be anti-police, but we are anti-police violence, and I don't like to see abuse of power from anyone. I don't care whether you're a retail store clerk or a police officer. It's all the same. If you're on your own little power trip, and it doesn't change right and wrong what the difference is. So I'm talking to him. It's whether I'm having an impact or not doesn't, I can't say. But maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. So we have a bit of a conversation. Eventually, I'm taken through, processed. Now, they want me to give up my name. So, they've got my stuff in a bag.
I don't even know your name.
Yeah, Yeah, and I can't tell the police. If I say I'm Dr. O to the police officer, that's providing false information, and that's a charge. So when they asked my name, I always just say I'm John Doe. Actually, when they first brought us in and they were writing, putting names on our tags, and she said, "What's your name?" I said, "John Doe," and she wrote down J-O-H-N. I go, "No, I spell it J-O-N." And she goes, "Well, when you write it, you can spell it when you're writing it how you want or whatever." But it was just one of those moments. It was just a little joke with her. So I'm John Doeing, and so now I'm taken up where they've got my bag. And they're like, "Okay, well, we're going to throw away your stuff because there's too many John Does. When you get to, when it gets to property, they're just going to toss it out." And I go, "No, you're not. It's got bag's got a number on it. All I need is that number. You're going to write me a receipt for that." So they realize that their bluff's not going to work. So then they like skip me on and go to the next step in processing, which is like going through metal detectors and emptying my pockets and taking off my shoes and doing all these other things. And then I'm put in with everybody else at this point. Then they transfer us like to the other side of the room for some reason. I'm not sure why, because the cage on the other side is just the same as the cage on the side we were on. But for however their system is, that's how they've got it set up. So we're moved over.
And keep in mind 200 A.R.R. arrests in N. New York City for A. N. I night is L O low.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I can't imagine.
So it's not like they're being overtaxed their system.
Yeah, I can't believe that this is a problem.
So they could have T.A. taken you
to central processing.
To central processing.
Right. I definitely think they could have done that, particularly for this. And like, and at the area that I'm arrested now, like when I get there and there's all these other people, it becomes clear to me that they were arresting people all over. That it wasn't just this corner that I was at, because this group was a relatively small group. Like I said, no more than like 20 people. I mean, we're on the sidewalk. I mean, we're not like 2 to 3 to abreast. We're not. Nothing's really going
and
on.
And U H A happen to be a PRO protester who is on his way to dinner.
Right.
Who is on, is that it? They A are arrested P people who weren't even protesters.
Right. Well, the courts had come down before these actions that it's now back, I guess, in February 15th, 2003, they had these mass arrests where they blocked off like entire city blocks and just swept the entire block, wouldn't let people leave the area and just arrested hundreds of people. And it was, the courts came down and said, like, this isn't going to be tolerated. Not sure exactly what led up to the courts, like, coming out and saying, like, you can't do that again. What I kind of pieced together, or at least my theory is that the police decided, okay, well, we'll block off half streets and see what the courts have to say about that after the fact, without ever, like, thinking, oh.
As if it is
the size of the state. Right.
That is the issue.
Right. These people, they're thinking strategy as much as anyone else is thinking strategy. It's all like, okay, well, let's play this way. Oh, I don't know what you meant. You know, they're playing dumb, just along. You know, and they'll do everything they can to do what they to achieve their goals. Now, their goal, in my opinion, was simply to, like, once the news media seemed to have parted company with these, with the main protester, these direct actions at this mouse block, was that, okay, the Republicans are in the theaters, now let's arrest people, let's clear people. And began just grabbing people, like, going, okay, this section, getting this, you let us into a van and then hit another section. So there's, like, we're at Pier 57. Now, like I said, like, I'm covered at this point in goo from the floor. Haven't eaten. It wouldn't be until about 3 or 4 in the morning before we'd be transferred to central processing. And that was, like, my arrest started at 5:30 in the afternoon. It's now, like, you know, 6 to 9 hours later. They load us onto more vans, and then they take us into central processing. Now, during all this time, every now and then, like, a cop would have a little conversation or be near a section of the fence that I was in and talk to me. The cops had complained to me that they couldn't run the air conditioner because they have to sit in there all the time. And it was hot in New York at this point. I mean, it's like, you know, averaging like 80 degrees with 90% humidity. And I was like, well, why won't they let you run the air conditioner? And they, well, I don't know. Or they ask me, they say, they won't let us turn that thing on. And they point to this object. I'm like, what's that thing? Because it's this big, like, house. looking object. You know, and he's like, oh, that's the air conditioner. And I'm like, they won't let you turn that on? And he's like, no. And I was like, oh, it seems weird. But, and like, we had been making fun, like, when they brought these vans in, they left them idling in this enclosed space. And the cops were sitting much closer, their little station, to these vans than we were. So if they were, like, trying to run it for, you know, to expose us to carbon monoxide, it's like, the cops are getting them worse exposure. So we thought, are they just don't have any brains? You know, why are they, you know, we're questioning, joking amongst ourselves about all this. They also complained to me that they weren't allowed to wash the floor, that they had wanted to wash and paint the floor. But that the Hudson River Authority people said no because the toxins would run off into the river, and they didn't want that.
Oh, my. That's so, something we hadn't heard about.
Yeah. So and this is information coming from police officers. Now, what their understanding of the situation may or may not be, but I worked for an environmental consulting firm for 3 years, and I can see that being an issue, but remediation, there's way, if you can't do one thing, you can do something else. There's precautions that can be taken. There's no impossible situation. So, now, I imagine with the air conditioning issue relates to the asbestos problem.
Yes.
So, that was probably why they weren't allowed to turn that on. But, you know, the cops are never going to be going to give any information, or if they have it, they're not sharing it with me.
In reality, the CICO, the cops, and the protesters are in the same boat.
Right. And even in a larger scale in society, we're in the same boat.
Yes.
But
yes.
People maintain power by dividing everyone up. If everyone thinks that they're alone, then it's harder to do things. If we all start going, oh, wait a minute, we all have a common enemy, let's start working together. Because I would tell the cops this constantly. I'm like, God, you guys had the biggest, best bargaining chip to ever come down the pipe was the Republican National Convention. If you guys said, you know what, we want a contract, we want it this way, or we're not working overtime.
B-O-S-T, Boston, P.
Boston Police.
Boston Police, and F-I-R, Fire, Fire Department, did that. And they got what they wanted, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's like I kept saying this over and over to police through my 30 some odd hour ordeal. If you guys learn nothing else from this, learn a little solidarity and whip your union into shape. You guys are getting screwed. And so now they transport us onto these vans. We go to central processing. Which was a madhouse. It was absolutely the funniest thing I think I had seen. And it wasn't just because at this point I haven't slept in 12 or 15 hours and I'm just tired. It was.
Have you eaten anything
yet?
No.
Still haven't eaten. They didn't feed us at
They give you any water?
They gave you, they had like water dispensers, you know, like those 5-gallon jugs, and you got a paper cup, which you were expected to keep track of. You know, it's not like you pretty much set it on the floor and hope someone doesn't step on it or knock it, you know, whatever. Because once it's hit that floor, you're not really going to want to put it in your mouth. I've had water.
Yeah, that's it.
We're taking a central processing. We'd be in little groups of five people at a time with a police officer, and they'd take us from one space to another, and then that cop would get into a debate with the cop that he's trying to transfer custody of us over to, and they're like, we can't take anymore. No, take them downstairs, or take them upstairs, or take them. So we're constantly moving around, and nobody seems to have any kind of plan about where we're... I would think that this would be a little... Pier 57 seemed pretty organized, but here at Central Processing, it seems to be total chaos. So I'm thinking, well, maybe they have maybe that's why we were taken to Pier 57. Maybe there are more people than this group that I see have seen so far. So I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe this John Doe strategy thing might work a little bit better. You know, maybe there's a lot more people than I think of, you know, on my side here. So at one point, you're supposed to see an EMT to be medically evaluated. So I'm taken to an EMT.
And what's an EMT?
Emergency medical technician. They're like the firemen that respond.
I-T-T. Little late for that.
A little late, yeah. Well, it's not like they're going to be able to, like, you know, evaluate. They're there to fill out a form, which is some basic questions, you know, about your medical history and how are you sick now, you know, kind of. They have you been homeless? Are you a drug user? You know, just some kind of questions. Now, going in to see the EMT, this guy starts giving me a lecture right away. I don't want any of your bullshit. You're blah, 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 blah. And I'm all like, what is this guy's problem? Because I haven't said word one to him yet. But I'm guessing that he knew I was a John Doe coming into this. And then he looks at me at the end of his little lecture and goes, you're 24. All right, well. You're allowed to have any misconception you want. I'm under no obligation to correct you, and I'm not giving up information about myself. So.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm all. Well, he could have told me I was purple. I wasn't going to argue. So. Then I'm passed down the line to this other guy, who then asked me these various questions: Are you homeless? Are you a drug user? Are you taking any medications now? Blah, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yes, no. I give them some information, basically, because it's like I'm trying to, like, set it up so in the event that because I am borderline asthmatic, that if I need treatment, then I've already set it up on paper so that hopefully it'll speed the process up in the event that I do have some sort of toxic seizure from this exposure to these chemicals that I'm wearing all over me. So, after that, we're photographed, fingerprinted, and taken into a holding cell eventually. And so now it's about 7 a.m. And this is the first time that I've been near a phone. So now I can call my lawyer, which I don't have when I'm just calling the National Lawyers Guild, find out what's going on, give them information. Call them and tell them I'm doing John Doe and I'm doing jail solidarity, which is a tactic. They go, okay, we don't have information for you yet. Call back in an hour. So I call them back in an hour, and they give me a specific attorney's name that she's going to be representing us. I am told to ask for the desk sergeant, I want to speak to my lawyer. This is her name. And pretty much to expect that that's not going to happen. Okay. So I do that, and the desk sergeant won't even come down and talk to me. So I don't know badge numbers or names. I just have this, you know, disembodied voice from down the hall shouting back at me. So his opinion is that she'll ask for me. And I'm thinking, I don't think she's gonna. I don't think she even, this is a referral. She doesn't even, and I'm John Doe. But again, they're trying to get me to give up my information. So over the course of the next hour and a half, they denied me 3 times access to my attorney, with me specifically asking for her. We're fed. We're now food. There was 2 pieces of white bread with a slice of bologna. If you're a vegetarian, you can have a slice of Kraft cheese. Well, that's not exactly a vegetarian alternative, but that's what they call it. So essentially, anytime I'm arrested, it's basically that I'm on hunger strike automatically. there's just not food that I'm going to put in my mouth. So we did discover that the food made excellent pillows. It comes sealed in plastic, so we'd rest our heads against the walls, lay down on it, and everyone's like, people are trying to take naps. People have been up since, you know, if they were all arrested around 5:30, like me, it's now, It's now been a day. It's now been over 12 hours. We've been up all night. We've never been taken to any place that's suitable for sleeping. We're never given pillows or blankets or bed space. We never have a lights out where, because we've been moving around through hallways and different rooms and all this other nonsense. So they're bringing in more people. One group that I met there were bicyclists who were riding their bikes to the march on Sunday. So this is still Sunday morning for them when they're going to the thing. They were not doing critical mass. This was a small group of bicycles. I don't know how many people were in their group. Because there's only two or three of them in my cell. And they tell me that they got blocked off, like cut off in the street, and they were following, you know, obeying traffic laws, occupying only one lane, and were just told that they were under arrest and were arrested. They never even made it to the UPJ march. And I'm like, so you guys have been arrested like since 10 o'clock? Or sometime that morning, like, because the march, I think, officially started at 10. So they were essentially en route, so figure sometime between 8 and 10 they were arrested. They told me, yeah, and one of the funny things was is that as they were going there, they passed by a store, and this woman who had been shopping there joined their ride. Not for any other reason outside of that they were just bicycles and they were all traveling in the same direction. And she was arrested. And was telling the officers when they had her cuffed, and like, officer, those are my groceries. I'm going home. I'm not even going to this march. Now, when you take into processing, they won't let you have perishable items in your stuff that they've taken from you that they're sending what is it called? To property. So, like, I had some power bars in my bag, and they had thrown those away in my bottle of water. So, if they took her to processing, they would have thrown away her groceries. This, you know, and I don't know how much she bought. I don't know and describe the bags, but you start thinking about the level of common sense that people have to engage in, because police are given discretion in enforcement of the law. So even if they were under orders to arrest all these people, you would think, let this woman go. So, but they, men and women aren't kept together, so we don't know what happened to her.
But the MEXSS, the message is STA, stay, A,
stay away.
Stay away.
Right. So they said they thought it was really funny that she had said, when this is all over, I'm going to write such a letter. That was like her comment. And if she feels, and I'm sure she would probably get an apology letter from somebody. But so we're in these cells, and all day long they continue to take people out. Now when they're transferring you and moving you around, at this point they now have this printout that has the picture they've taken of you, which is actually a pretty good resolution photo on paper, with your name and all this other information on it. They ask for you by name. Now you're in cells of 50, 60 people at a time that they can get into these things. They call people out and they ask you your name to verify, ask you your birth date to verify that you're the guy that you claim to be. Even though I guess they have a hard time matching up photos and names, or photos and people's faces. So they would take people out and lead them out. We assume that they're being, like, at this point being charged or whatever, and then they're probably getting out. They don't come and get me until 10 p.m.
Wow.
And they're asking for John Doe. Now, John Doe 1 and 2, myself being John Doe 1, are in the same cell. Like, John Doe 2 has been brought in. And I know there's a John Doe 3 somewhere, but I haven't met him. So they come in and go, John Doe. And I go, well, which one? There's two of us in here. And he's like, well, when's your birth date? And I go, I didn't give up my birth date, and I'm not going to tell you. Well, there's one on this form. And I'm like, well, okay. I'm still not going to tell you what my birth date is. Well, I'm not going to transfer you. I'm not moving you. Well, I don't care. I can sit here or sit there. Makes no difference to me. Because they're not telling us where we're going. We don't. They don't provide you information. So I was like, it's up to you. Whatever you want to do. I'll sit back down. Because I can see the photo. I know it's me that they want to move. And he thinks about it for a minute and finally decides that he's going to take me out of the cell. So he takes me down the hall, takes me up these stairs, and I'm brought up into a room where they have these two smaller cells. And I see people that have left my initial cell over 6 hours ago. And I'm thinking, they're continuing to warehouse. Okay, this is interesting. Like, I assume that they had already been, like, in front of a judge and were out, given their tickets or did whatever and are out. So I'm like, oh, well, maybe this is where we're staying for the night. The guard tries to transfer me over, give him this other new guard that's there already, this paperwork. And the guy goes, what's your birth date? And I go, I'm not telling you what my birth date is. And he's like, well, there's one on this form. And I'm like, I can't guess what it is. Like, you know, so he's like, you're a dick. Why do you got to be a dick? Take him down there. I don't care. Get him out of here. And I'm like,
No. I'm not Dick. I'm John.
John, yeah, totally.
J-O-A.
John. So at this point, like, I don't know where I'm going. I'm assuming I'm being maybe put into a solitary cell or something. So we go through another, like, gated doorway, and I'm in a courtroom. So I'm going in front of a judge, and I haven't seen an attorney yet.
S-U- R, R, E.
Am I sorry?
Surreal.
Oh, yeah. It's surreal. Yeah, it's like. And keeping in mind, I haven't eaten, I haven't slept, and I'm covered in oil. Okay. I'm like dirty and filthy and stinky and just like I'm wearing shorts, and now I'm in this like air-conditioned room. Like, not a comfortable experience. But so I'm sitting in this room thinking, all right, what's going to happen now? What's my strategy? What's my next move? You know, because I've never actually made it all the way in front of a judge ever before. I've always been, like, cited and released. So I'm sitting there listening, trying to figure out what's going on, and this woman comes over, and she's like, who's John Doe? I go, I'm John Doe. And she's like, okay, I'm, and she introduces herself to my attorney.
Wow.
I'm like, all right. Good thing. So I have a quick meeting with her in this little private booth they have in this room. And she's like, all right, well, which John Doe are you? And I go, well, the only thing I know is I'm being charged with resisting arrest and extra charges, whatever, extra or special charges, whatever these are. So she's going, she has the three John Doe paperwork. And she goes, okay, none of these are for, no one's being charged with resisting arrest. I go, okay, well, interesting. I can see one of the files has lots of paper stapled to it, and they're warrants. And I can see in one of the paragraphs it says Puerto Rican. I'm like, okay, well, I don't have any outstanding warrants, and I'm not Puerto Rican, so that one's definitely not me. So you just have to figure out between these two others, and... She's like, well, okay, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, well, I'm doing jail solidarity right now, and I'm fine doing that.
And what is jail solidarity?
Jail solidarity is not giving up any information, which makes it difficult for them to process you, to charge you. There's other parts of this tactic. It generally works better with larger groups. And she's like, okay, well, the main jail solidarity group really isn't going to happen until after Tuesday when the direct actions. So you're about a day or two ahead of everybody. And what's going to happen is you're going to end up in alone in here for a little while.
You're going to be what?
Be alone.
Uh-huh. Hey. It was not... planned. It was not my idea.
Right.
To be arrested.
Right. Exactly.
On my way to dinner.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not. But I. It's all like, you know what? This. I was gonna be in here eventually. Whether I spend a couple extra hours or not. Not that big of a deal. she's like, okay, we can probably get to a court date around, like, the 14th. Thought about it. I was like, all right, I can deal with the 14th. Mm. Which, keeping in mind, this is, like, October 3rd or August 30th that I'm arrested. Mm. And now it's the... No, it's not even the 31st. It's the 30th. It's Monday. Mm. So I'm thinking, all right, I can probably hang tough. I'll be fine. I can do this. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, you know, righteously angry, you know, just over this whole incident. I know there's going to be so much more to this later. It's still all going to come down the pipe. So she's like, yeah, she goes, here's some suggestions. And she's like, you know, eat some, don't go on a hunger strike yet. If you don't need to be a martyr. There's
what? What hunger strike? Nobody's offered me any.
But yeah, no, yeah, I'm not really. I'm involuntarily on hunger strike as it is. If you ever try to like fast, it's like the first two or three days, you'll feel hungry, but then your body reacts to it and kind of just goes away, and it's easier to deal with. So I don't plan on eating anything simply because that's gonna like upset my stomach as more than. Plus, what they're feeding me is going to upset my stomach. So I'm like, okay, fine. So we go up in front of the judge. And she refuses to arraign me as a John Doe. And my attorney's speaking for me. And she's like, well, my attorney's not prepared to give up his name. And she goes, well, send him back into holding. So I'm transferred back into this holding cell outside the courtroom.
Now, is she has the right to do that?
A judge, I'm going to have to say yes. She did it. Now I thought I was kind of disturbed by the fact that the judge had an American flag pinned to the outside of her black cloak, which is supposed to represent her neutrality. So I'm kind of wondering. So, I mean, in retrospect, her refusing to arraign me works in my favor because of writ of habeas corpus. That if I'm running out the clock on their 24 hours to charge me, now my attorney can file a writ and get me out of jail. Because they're like, charge my client or release him, basically. I'm not thinking that at the time. I'm not really sure what's going on. Too much. I'm wondering at which point do I get to present a defense. I still don't officially know what I'm charged with because none of the paperwork said resisting arrest, which was the only thing I've been told I will be charged with. So I go back into holding, and there's like probably two protesters left in these cells.
And what does your attorney say at that point?
She's just like, you know, we'll be in touch. You know, like, and I know her through reputation. Uh-huh. So I'm absolutely comfortable with my fate being in her hands. Uh-huh. I'm not worried.
Yeah.
Like I said, you have to have some faith in the court. It's like you don't know who you're going to get, but there has to be like some faith that some things are going to work out. So I'm sent back into holding. Now this is probably the worst part of the experience. The guard that's in charge of us, which is a different guard than the one that was initially there when I was brought through the first time. Is listening to the Michael Savage radio show. So I probably spend like the next hour listening to that. One of the protester guys that's in there with me feels it's his duty to argue with the guard about this nonsense.
Get anywhere else?
No.
What, you don't hear
it? Yeah, this is what CBS, NBC, ABC are not going to put on for you.
Okay, so what were you saying? What were you just asking? Or saying? We're talking about the him trying to talk the other protester out of arguing about
with this cop, because essentially he's just going to he's just adding to his own level of frustration. And I go, look, you're dealing with somebody that's got the mind of a 3-year-old. Okay, listen to some of the things he says. At one point, the guard had said, yeah, the problem with this country, and he's like talking to another guard or something, are the women and the homosexuals. And the thought that crossed in my mind was, yeah, let's get rid of the women and see how this guy feels about the homosexuals after about 6 months. he's probably going to be whistling a different tune. But...
And? but for him, it would not be MU much different for the guard. It wouldn't be much for the guard. It wouldn't be much different. How do you mean? If they got rid of the women and the homosexuals, why is that? He's not having sex with anybody anyway.
Yeah, well, well, he's not. Well, that could be a case. Supposedly he's married and has kids, but it's the fact that he's just. I'm trying to get this other protester to realize that this guy thinks in very simplistic terms of that there's no variation in life. You know, it's like this way and this way only. And it's like, you're not really living life, are you? If you're just following a script, you're just following a script and doing what you're supposedly to be doing. And you're not even asking the question, who wrote that script? So the cops, what is he? Like, he's talking to another guard at one point and had said he was upset that Jersey wasn't going to allow NYPD across the border for whatever reasons that MPD might have to cross the border into Jersey because NYPD are allowed to have hollow-tipped bullets, which are armor-piercing bullets, cop-killer bullets, and Jersey doesn't allow them at all. And he's like, yeah, don't allow other people to have it, but cops should be able to have it. Well, what's a cop going to do with that besides shoot another cop? Because they're the only other people wearing bulletproof armor. So, but he can't even understand these ideas. And it's like, why can't you just have standard ammo? You know, leave the bullet piercing, you know, in the closet. But the other protester feels it's his moral duty to try to correct this person. So I kind of just can't wait for this other guy to get out of my cell so I can get some sleep.
Yeah.
I'm there for like another hour and a half or so. And they keep bringing in new prisoners. And these people aren't protesters anymore. These are the people that they actually catch in the process of crimes. For pretty much everyone they brought in seemed to be there on some sort of loitering or drunk driving kind of charge. The one guy's brought in that's real sketchy. He wasn't even allowed to have shoelaces. And he's freaking out even the other prisoners. Because he keeps just kind of like doing these crazy eyes and playing with himself through his pants. And everyone's just kind of wondering what this guy's going to do. He's pretty much, it's pretty obvious he's a tweaker. His brain's fried. We don't know how far into his little trip he may or may not be, or if this is just now his natural state of being. He goes to sleep at one point, and he keeps having these weird muscle spasms while he's and shouting things while he's sleeping, and everyone just kind of like watching him, thinking, you know what? If he wakes up and goes into some sort of crazed fit, like it's going to be a few minutes before that guard can get that key through that door to come in here. like everyone's just kind of watching him and. I'm a little nervous, but I quickly pick up that these people are moving. They're waiting to go in. They're going into court. So they're only going to be in the cell with me for 15 minutes, 20 minutes at most, it seems. So they're moving in and out pretty quickly, and I see, like, 20 people parade through going into this court.
Wow.
I'm still in there. And, again, I just have to assume that this is where I am for the night. Mm-hmm. Because I can't imagine court's going to go on much longer.
And what time is this now?
This is getting to be 11 o'clock at night on Monday. So I'm trying to sleep, but I really can't. And then I'm transferred again. And this time I'm transferred to a cell, and I meet John Doe number 3, who's also not Puerto Rican. John Doe number 2 is not Puerto Rican either. We're taken to this other cell, which is similar to the one that I was in, but smaller. So at this point, I'm like, okay, this is it. This is where I'm going to be spending the night. me and John does. So so we're trying to lay down on these little benches, and they're not even long enough for us to be on them. Only one of them's long enough for one of us. So I tell him, well, we'll switch off. You know, we'll get up in a couple hours, and we'll switch, and you can sleep on this longer one. And still no pillows, no blankets, or anything like this. No showers. We're kind of zoning out, and then they come in again to transfer us again. Still don't know where, you know, it's like, where can they possibly be taking us now? It's another courtroom. We're taken in front of another judge. Now, in this courtroom is my attorney's partner, the guy that she is practicing law as an extension. I'm not sure what the technical terms for this, but she's from California. She has a license to practice law in California. She does not have a license to practice law in New York. While I was in the first courtroom, this attorney that's in the courtroom now, and I forget his name, has approached the bench and said that, you know, this introduced her, my attorney, and said that she's an associate of his with a license to practice law in California, and that she will be working under his direction and is in his own right for the court for her to do it without him standing there, basically. And the judge has granted that permission. So now I'm in the courtroom with him, and he tells me he's going to be representing me here in this court, and that I'm being charged with 2 counts of disorderly conduct and 1 count of parading without a permit. And that they're violations. I mean, you know, what do I want to do? Or then he tells me that the earliest trial date like we're going to get is going to be around, like, the 29th. Yeah, this is...
Which is, like, a month away.
Right. And yeah. Assuming there's no other problems. And I was like, okay. Now, at this point, I have to think, can I get people to pay my rent for me? It's going to... And he's like, you're not even being charged... You're being charged with violations. They're not... It's like... Like parking tickets are less. And keep in mind, you're thinking, okay, I've been detained for like 34 hours. Can you imagine being detained for 34 hours because you have a parking ticket? Mm. Or for speeding or something like this?
Mm. And you?
We're on my way home. Right. This is just being caught up in a sweep. So what we decide is that we're going to go for what's an automatic dismissal, which is what the court does is that they seal the case and they put it on the docket for 6 months from now. And then if in the next 6 months I'm not rearrested for anything, that case comes up in front of the judge at that time, and then because I haven't been arrested, it just gets destroyed. It's like it never happened. So I'm like, okay, if you can get the DA to cop, go to that, we'll do it. And he's like, well, you're going to have to give up, like, your name and stuff. And I'm like, all right, we'll have to do it. And part of this that I'm having to give up being jail solidarity is the fact that I just didn't have the plan going in to do this. I was expecting a different set of circumstances for things to play out a little bit differently. I don't have the support network I needed set up in advance. So basically, it's a failure of my own strategies, you know, or a failure to plan ahead. So we do that. So I'm officially brought up in front of the judge and arraigned. I'm charged with the 2 counts, the 1 count of parading without a permit, and 2 counts of burglary from the warrants. My file was the warrant file.
Oh, my. Are you aware of these warrants?
Well, they're not my warrants. Remember, one was a Puerto Rican.
Right.
So I tell the attorney, I go, those aren't my warrants. I've never committed burglary. I've never been arrested outside of for protesting, and that was once, and I wasn't even charged then. And I've seen it. I know one says Puerto Rican and describes the suspect as being Puerto Rican. Now, what it was is that these individuals were caught, like, in the act of burglary, didn't have ID on them, refused to give up their information, and were arraigned as John Doe's. Mm. And they matched my general description, male, about my height, about my build, about my age.
Oh, my.
So they've
just overlooked the Puerto Rican part
right. I never actually saw, like, all the paperwork, so I don't know if the second warrant actually was what the race of that other person was. He may have been Caucasian. But I go, you know, I've never even been in New York before, like, 4 days ago. This is, and so the burglars were, like, in Queens. So he tells the judge, and he's like, my client has informed me that he's never been arrested. These aren't his. They're not whatever. And the judge looks at it, and she goes, this one says he's Puerto Rican. And, like, immediately just tosses that one off to the side. And she looks at the other one, and she's like, well, how old are you? And I go, I'm 35 years old. When were you born? I was born in 1969. Your paperwork says that you're 24. Now, keep in mind, it's a charge if I've lied to the police. I go, I've never given up my information. The only time that I can imagine that you guys just came up with that is when this EMT told me, flat out, says, you're 24 years old, and I didn't feel an obligation to correct him. She apparently believes me. And she asked me my name and my address and other information. She thinks about it for a while, and like I don't know how this is going to play out. This is kind of an interesting thing. I'm up on burglary charges here because
if she needs to think about it,
yeah.
Right. It's something to be nervous about.
Yeah, kind of.
Is that what you mean? It's something to be nervous about if it's not obvious to her.
Right. So
she should let you go.
So we're all waiting for her to make her decision, and she hands a warrant to one of her clerks, and she goes, put these back in the warrant file. No, you know what? Dismiss them. They're too old. So two people got their records, at least part of their records, clean because I went through the system. Those warrants got dismissed. Way.
But do they know who those two people? No, do they know it of the people who had their stuff?
Oh no, they don't. They don't know. And you have to figure if you were caught burglarizing someplace, most likely what happened to that person is either A, they fled, like went to Canada or took off and or whatever. Or they got popped on another crime, and then, you know, they're not going to go, oh, you know what, by the way, I've got to go to court and face this other judge, you know, on this charge. Just, you know, took the one charge or whatever they got caught with and processed, and then it went to warrant when they didn't show up on time.
Right.
So, you know, or anything could have happened to them. But whatever it was, they're, you know, they're not too, apparently, I'm sure they're not losing any sleep over it. So those two warrants get dismissed. I get my automatic dismissal. The DA has agreed to that. And I'm free to go at this point. And I'm walked out of the courtroom. It's about 1 a.m. in the morning on Tuesday.
Wow.
And picked up by jail support immediately. There's a person in the courtroom. The jail support people are, they're cheering. Like when we were going through processing, there was this one point where we passed an open window. And I heard them outside cheering, and I managed to stick my hand out and make a peace sign at them, which got a bigger cheer. So I was just letting them know we could hear them and appreciate their efforts. So she's like, I'd like to get you medical attention and some food and, you know, whatever else, you know, if you want to come with me. I'm like, absolutely. Where are we going? It's like, she's like, it's just across the street here. So we walk out of the courtroom and go across the street, and I'm given, like, salad and pasta and stuff, and they give me some salve stuff for my wrist, and where's a payphone around here? I need to call. I want to call my friends and let them, because I've been in touch with my people I'm staying with, let them know what's going on. Now, the last time I called them, I said, you know, it's getting late. You're probably not going to hear from me again until tomorrow, because I've limited quarters. It's 50 cents to make a call on a payphone inside jail, where it's 25 cents on the street in New York. So I've got limited access. And I'd rather spend my money calling my attorney than just kind of telling my friend, oh, by the way, I'm still in jail. I go, I'll be out, I'm fine. I've given my attorney my friend's phone number and said, you know, you contact her and keep her informed. She and her roommate are really heavy sleepers, and the phone's not in, like, my friend's room at all, so I don't expect them to answer, but I'm given one of their cell phones, and I call, and I get no answer. I leave a message going, oh, by the way, I'm going to be over there at some point to expect me early in the morning. I couldn't get into any shelters. They don't they stop accepting people like at 11 o'clock.
Wow.
I meet up with some people who had written down emergency housing phone numbers that other activists that had posted to news groups. And I call all of these numbers, like three or four of them, and get no answers. So I'm like, all right, well, what am I going to do? So at this point, I decide I'm going to go to property and try to get my stuff back. Property won't release anything to me without an ID, which is back at my friend's house. So, my friend's roommate goes my friend that I'm staying with has the month of August off. Her roommate goes to work sometime in the morning, which I think is around 6:30. So I figure there's this kind of narrow window where I can get into the apartment. So I'm talking with the medics, and they tell me it's probably going to take me a couple hours to get from where I was to where I needed to be. And that was going to, you know, kind of line up where I might have to wait an hour outside the apartment or something. So I decide that what I should do is go home. Go to my friend's house and just kind of sit there, as opposed to sit outside on the streets, you know. So I go there, and I end up waiting a couple hours out in the hallway before my friend's roommate gets up and lets me in around 7:30 in the morning. And while I'm doing that, I'm saying, keep in mind, I'm covered in oil. I'm just dirty. I'm tired. I haven't eaten. It's hot. It's muggy. And people are starting to leave this building going to work, just kind of normal, everyday people. And I'm thinking, oh, God, please don't let them call the police and say, there's this strange guy sitting in the lobby of our building outside of these two girls who live alone, you know, apartment, or these two girls that live together. Apartment, because I can just imagine how that conversation's going to go. Well, I don't have any ID, officer. It's inside the apartment. But they won't open the door because they sleep with earplugs in. They can't hear me. I've been knocking on the door. I have been ringing the bell, trying to hopefully thinking, maybe they'll hear it and get up, thinking, it's Dr. O. So I'm just having this like, oh, God, please get up. Please get up. So eventually they do. I get in. I get a shower, I get fed, and then I crash. Mm. And I sleep for, oh, God, I don't know how long. I don't get up until well into the afternoon, and at which point, the only thing I can really do at this point, because I can't go to the direct actions, I know I'll be rearrested. In which case, if I am rearrested, I have to face the original charges plus whatever else they're charging me with. Plus, it kind of, I think, looks bad. It's like I broke the deal, you know, so I don't know. Maybe I'll have to talk to some other people who have more experience and find out if that's a real threat to later deals or not. So I go back to do jail support, and while I'm there, it's like we learn that they're not holding court. They're not processing people. They're not letting them out. And at this point, the lawyers have been filing writ of habeas corpus, which are being denied. The police just aren't letting people go. And now Bush is going to give his speech on Thursday, so I go, oh, they're just going to keep everybody off the streets. And, you know, if most people seem to be charged with these violations, I think I heard of four felony charges. And one of them was for these guys who had done a banner hang, and the police officer stepped out onto a skylight under his own choice, and even though he was told, no, that's not going to hold your weight, look, it's cracked. Right. And fell through it and cut up his leg.
Yeah.
So they're being charged with assault on an officer, even though, you know, they obviously didn't touch him. But, like, the police can charge you with whatever they want. Whether it holds up in court, they're not really interested. It's not their strategy to prosecute us right. and lock us away. It's just to prevent us from engaging in these direct actions.
M-E-S-S, the message is...
Stay away again.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make it marginalize us, say, don't do it. But, you know, it's, like I said, it's like they were charging me with nonsense. Parading without a permit? What constitutes me being in a parade? So I'm planning legal actions against the police at this point now because, you know, I consider my arrest to be completely false. and unjustified, along with my detention and everything else. So I'm talking with the ACLU and some other attorneys, and we'll see how things go from here. Right now, it's too early to tell.
Even after the C convention, COU court, ordered the city to let the protesters out.
Yeah, and it fined them for however many they didn't have. Yeah. Now that's to me, it's funny because it's like basically the government's fining itself, so it takes money from one pocket and puts it in the other pocket. It's, you know, no real penalty. There's no, it's like me fining myself. Well, I didn't go grocery shopping or clean the bathroom this week, so I'm going to take $1 out of my wallet and put it over here, you know, or something. I still have that dollar. It's
So what they are trying to do is take away the BILL
Bill of Rights.
Right.
They'll do whatever they want to do until they can't. And the Bill of Rights, they've been chipping away at that for the longest time. This whole whatever point they decided that you had to get permission to have protest, you know, to have these rallies and marches is
like you were not even a SSEM assembling.
Right.
When you were arrested.
Right. I think I literally was like two blocks away from a subway station. I was just going in the direction that I knew there was going to be one on this block eventually. I didn't know exactly how far it was, but I'm pretty, when I looked back at the map and was trying to figure out where exactly I was arrested, I think I was like two, three blocks away at most. It's going to be, and yeah, they're just going to sweep areas. And like when even these protest pens, there was a case in Boston where they came down and said, look, it's illegal. You can't, you are violating their rights. You can't have protest pens. The entire country is a free speech zone.
So what? That's the way the cops are acting about it.
Right. They're following orders, and they're in their simplistic mind way of thinking. That's their job, is to follow these orders. I think one cop said something like, why don't you just vote? They do vote. But that doesn't change things necessarily. It's not instant.
There was a P-R-O, a protest on in N New York that O N only one W. Oh, only one woman showed up for this protest. Right. A L O lot of P-R-E. A lot of press was there. And A-L. Lot of P-O. Police.
Really? At the NYC, during the convention?
Yeah, during that period. There was, okay. You know how there were a lot of different protests
going
that went on?
Right,
yeah,
right.
So there was one that only this one woman showed up.
Interesting. I hadn't heard about this one. Yeah.
They arrested her.
Really? For this one?
For B. L. Blocking.
For blocking a
sidewalk. The. And. For. P-A-R, parading.
For parading without a permit? It's, well, which was she doing? Was she parading without a permit, or was she blocking the sidewalk? Because it seems to me you can't do both.
And the P, the press, W-R, wrote A, about it, but their S-T-O, their stories, did not make the paper.
Yeah, it's, you know, corporations who make, I mean, newspapers are in the business of selling ad space. And they're just looking for sensationalism. They're not they're not looking to fulfill their responsibility that comes with having no government restriction on what they do of informing the public. They just want to sell ad space. And that means that they can't upset the people that pay their bills, which there had been a joke or a discussion going around at the ACLU meeting about what was going to happen with the UPJ march, what was going to happen when it was officially over, and someone had basically had shouted out, well, Macy's is having a sale. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. Why don't we march into Macy's at the end of this parade route if it's near the building and just wander Macy's?
Can't read my writing.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have to call it.
Well, I just, you know, I'm just aware that it's after 11:30, so I thought you have enough time if you wanted to do any kind of rap or anything. Or is that, yeah, is it, yeah, okay. So, John Doe.
Yes. Dr. John Doe.
Dr. John Doe. I don't know L O Lob. Lob's real name either.
Yeah, that's.
And I have K N. I've known him for a lot of years, right?
Yeah, and I at least know part of Lob's name. But it's names are what people call you, and right. Lob is Lob, right. And I'm Dr. O, and right. So people call us, so we just let it go. It's just our names. It's just, like I said, it's what we get called, so we answer to it. So.
Okay, so that's a wrap.
Okay.
Player's gonna stop. Hit play again.